continue now with Chris Bosheim, whose paper is entitled Digital Literary Criticism and the End of History.
Okay, thank you. So to identify the collapse of the USSR as a defining moment in the history of literary criticism, as the title of this paper sort of overtly does, is perhaps to do a disservice to the complexity of the historical moment, say the least, and tracing its effects within the discipline more broadly would probably be a project far beyond the scope of a single paper. One might find it indeed difficult to argue that a sequence of critics as diverse as Bruno Latour, Eve Sedgwick, and Rita Felsky, calling for a return to reparative and generative readings as opposed to the deconstructive or paranoid ones associated with the hermeneutics of suspicion, as they have in recent years, partake of a concerted critical effort which would fall along national, disciplinary, or institutional boundaries. This might just as likely turn out to be what Joe Cleary has called the perennial turnover of personnel, the shock of the old after critical theory's new is worn off, as it is more symptomatic of the broader cultural and political shifts regarding knowledge production in the academy after globalization. Nevertheless, there are particular critics and subfields within literary criticism I am interested in looking to and elucidating these trends in greater depth, and this paper will consider computational literary criticism as it has been practiced by Matthew Jockers, as well as those working within its millenarian antecedent world literary systems theory. I argue that the notion of the world literary system has done much to shape the conceptual foundations of quantum literary analysis due to its macroscopic disposition, which has provided computational literary critics with its foundational mediating theory. And on a more practical level as well, of course, the Italian literary scholar Franco Moretti has published work within both fields and in many ways acts as a bridging gap between the two. So on one side of this literary critical divide, it's somewhat crude when I was reading over it, I think, in retrospect, to segregate it out quite so schematically, but that's what I'm doing. There's been an increasing tendency towards cultural criticism, with the study of 19th and 20th century literatures broadening outwards to encompass then contemporaneous developments in the visual arts, film, fashion, architecture, scholarship and dance, and even up to our present day in the consideration of the neo-Victorian and the newly modern. Its stated aim being, of course, to perpetuate an ongoing critique of Western subjectivity and its manifestations within hegemonic race and gender relations. This is not in itself novel. Literary criticism has always been an interdisciplinary undertaking, as have revisionary critical theories according to contemporary political commitments. But these discursive shifts nevertheless stand in contrast to work undertaken in the digital humanities recently, which has largely abandoned culturalist approaches in favour of a focus on methodology, which has been noted by Alan Loop in the slide there, Joanna Drucker, Stephen Ramsey, and many others. My research, in a broader sense, calls for a re-engagement with cultural criticism against the reassertion of liberal bourgeois values, as well as the formalist, structuralist, and aesthetic critical perspectives, which are in the digital humanities and elsewhere on the rise. So the notion of world literature, with which world literary systems theorists are ostensibly concerned, it begins with the 18th century German playwright and poet Goethe, as a means of discussing literature disseminated both in and outside of translation, how it circulates within Europe and beyond, the international dialogue that the circulation of text facilitates. It crops up also, of course, in the Communist Manifesto, when Marx refers to the ways in which global capitalism and its outgrowth imperialism expedite the construction of a global monoculture. The concept of world literature, therefore, has a very fraught history and holds very different meanings for each critic making use of it. David Damrosch, more invested in the concept as a guarantor of contemporary literary excellence, whereas Moretti and Pascal Casanova use it as a means of relating literary form to geography and to locating text within a political geographic totality, the so-called World Republic of Letters. So I wrote this paper, I finished writing it the day before Pascal Casanova's passing on September 29th, because of her significance within world literary systems theory, I think it would be very odd to give a paper and not mention her book, The World Republic of Letters, which ostensibly started the field. And I'm saying all that in the hopes that what the criticisms I'm about to make don't seem totally insensitive. Casanova begins her work, The World Republic of Letters, arguing that literary critics tend to focus too much on individual words and individual sentences, to the exclusion of a broader context, with the effect that whole genres are understood as being inculcated by individual writers and individual works. But this is the essential thrust of her thesis, that literary forms propagate and secure themselves in a manner analogous to that of the modern nation state, especially as industrialism and international trade reach a critical point in the 19th century. Casanova's work is therefore quite indebted to that of Edward Said, who was one of the first critics to challenge the Eurocentricity of literary studies and to render imperialism an object of study within the humanities. However, Casanova largely dispenses with Said's political framework insisting on the centrality of Paris and London as international centres of great literature as opposed to the backward peripheries of Dublin or Latin America. The tendency to overlook these power dynamics lead to her, for example, citing critics who describe Latin America as culturally weak due to its low levels of literacy, unsophisticated communication and transport networks, without interrogating the historical reasons as to why this might be the case. Well, Casanova's framework implicitly promotes globalization as a positive force, and Reddy takes this a step further, going so far as to celebrate the cultural ramifications of the market in the form of the division of labor, whereby particular countries can specialize in writing either formally innovative or homogenizing cultural forms, a process which is, of course, again, expedited by the production of literature on an industrial scale. Emily Apter and Christopher Prendergast, among others, have criticized Casanova's operationalizing of world literature for these reasons, as well as its tacitly positive appraisal of commercial competition and its seeming belief in an international market in which literary value is objectively assessed. And of course, the failure to recognize that when nation states encounter one another, it's rarely on equal terms that they do so. The world literary system also depends on periodizing devices which divide human history into a series of phases with an attendant geist which is instrumental to cultural change. Virginia Jackson, as you see up there, has quite vehemently criticized this approach for its wedding of Western cultural production to narratives of civilizational progress, which downgrade non-European and oral texts due to their awkward place within these totalizing accounts. I think this is all symptomatic of a deeper problem within literary histories of genre themselves, especially as the novel, which treat the genres emerging effectively in parallel with the modernizing force of the industrialized nation state, a perspective which postcolonial critics have every reason to be suspicious of. I would argue, though, that rather than taking up the potential challenge of, as Apter names it, opening up literary history to radical desequencing, anachronic timelines, and non-neurochronic descriptions of duration, digital literary critics tend to lean into this tendency. So though Moretti claims the macroscopic vantage point afforded to the critic within world literary systems theory or quantitative literary history allow us to supersede the shortcomings of pre-existing and more well-established models of literary history, which would see the novel as emerging from the Romance and then giving way to the... Oh, wait, sorry, I've jumped ahead. Yeah, Moretti proposes instead, rather than seeing it as the Romance, the modern, postmodern literature, a selfish gene theory of literary history, whereby genres will emerge and establish their supremacy over other weaker genres. Moretti's paradigmatic case study here is the emergence and predominance of 20th century high modernism over the pre-existing paradigm of realism, sensationalism, gothic fiction, whatever genres you want to throw out in characterizing the 19th century literary milieu, remaining committed to the break hypothesis whereby 19th century literature is largely insignificant to modernism's emergence. Plenty of people have criticized him for this. I'll identify Tony Pinkney's as being among the strongest for, first of all, his failure to recognize modernism's rootedness, but also allowing for a productive definitional slippage between modernism and the avant-garde at turns to better suit his argument. So one of Moretti's attempts to understand how particular genres are popularized and become dominant include his examination of catalogues of 19th century libraries, assigning each of them a canonical rating based on how many of the authors in each catalogue appear in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. And you can see that graphed up there, figure 69, with the size of the collection going horizontally along the x-axis and the degree to which each circulating library's collection is composed of texts written by authors which appear in the DNB, Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, going vertically along the y-axis. Moretti argues that these approaches such as these, will allow for marginal texts to assume prominence, but unfortunately fails to locate this critical project relative to feminism or critical race theory to revisionist literary critical schools known for their methodological impulse to recover lost voices from the enforced silences of a patriarchal and predominantly white literary critical canon. Some Reddy's conclusions are therefore disappointingly confined to comments on writers such as Chekhov, Dickens, Dostoevsky, Flaubert, Joyce, Hardy. These are hardly outliers. On a petty methodological note as well, that isn't really enough samples to run a correlation test on. You'd need about 6 to 8 more, and I suspect he does not provide the correlation statistic because it is a borderline case. I don't think that actually is a significant finding. This chart up here shows us one of Moretti's attempts to sketch evolutionary history in action, an empirical attempt to demonstrate why Arthur Conan Doyle is the greatest writer of detective fiction of his time. We start from the bottom of the chart and then move upwards, with the successful strain moving on to the next generation on the right, while the weaker, less successful novels are bred out on the left. this first break in the evolutionary chain occurs because the mammals on the right make use of clues, with those on the left do not, and therefore become extinct. This continues onto the second, third, and fourth generations, with conditions for advancement depending on these clues being necessary, visible, and then decodable to the reader. As Moretti has it, readers notice the presence of clues in narratives, enjoy these books to successively greater extents as they fulfill these criteria to greater and greater extents, and thereby secure Arthur Conan Doyle's place in the canon at the expense of, and these are the authors he identifies somewhat confusingly as being left behind, Charles Dickens and Edward Bulwer Lytton, who don't feature on the chart. These writers intuit there is something about clues which appeal to readers, but do not understand why, and so do it in an incorrect way. So literary greatness here being understood as according with a kind of entrepreneurialism and a sensitiveness to commercial trends. Here is Moretti's map of free and direct discourse. His segregation of French and Russian naturalism from modernism on the basis of its greater degree of individuality, with a few bifurcations for ironic modes occurring along the way. As you can see, it's still a very canonical tree. Maybe you can't, it's not quite as defined as the last one, but you can still see that Moretti regards literary history as being perpetuated by individuals through a mastery of their form. Which is ironic because both Moretti and Jocker's advocacy for quantitative methodologies often depends on the scale of literary data which is now available for quantification, as they both argue the canon is detrimental to the study of literature because it amounts to less than 1% of what is actually published, and encourages critics therefore to become overly invested in the significance of particular words, sentences in isolation, whereas quantitative evidence, again, a better picture of things. So in refuting this point, we could point to this chart, but Stephen Ramsey provides a far more nuanced account in his outline of how quantitative methodologies very much depend upon qualitative procedures, the movement back and forth between one's knowledge of the text, the results of analysis, accounting for inconsistencies or contradictions, in much the same way as one would with any text. The use of statistics absolutely does not free us up from having to do these basic critical procedures. So there are many reasons one could supply in accounting for why sort of an apolitical school of literary criticism has become hegemonic within digital literary criticism, as I argue it has. Stephen Ramsey traces the apolitical tendency within digital literary criticism to the first digital humanities, well, the first digital humanities project, which, if you've never heard of it, was the Jesuit priest Roberto Busa's Index Themisticus, an IBM-sponsored project which created a lemmatized concordance of the complete works of the philosopher Thomas Aquinas's complete works, as well as a few other related authors on punch cards. You can see an example of it up there. So despite its technological component, this is a very old-fashioned form of scholarship rooted in philology, the critic playing as sort of an objective and clarifying role as opposed to one which is implicated or deforming. And it is, as Ramsey says, very much the kind of research project which post-war critical theory would have been a reaction. Busa's project is sort of unique in that it is considered foundational to digital humanities praxis. I don't think there's a single digital humanities textbook which doesn't begin with an outline of it. And this is what lends Ramsey's quite deterministic argument its plausibility that this is ground zero for this sort of thing. Ramsey also points to the logic of computation that one can't analyze what isn't there. And when you're using a spreadsheet or you're using a CSV file, in the end you have to make a decision as to what you're going to put in a particular cell. There has to be a one, there has to be a zero. There's no conversation that's possible in quantitative terms that goes beyond those limits. And whereas in literary criticism, you can have a long, extended conversation about what the text is not saying. And it is on that basis that Ramsey argues that computational and contemporary literary critical logics are incommensurable with one another. Another potential origin point for digital literary criticism's occasionally reactionary character, which my own research identifies, is the distinction quantitative literary critics tend to draw between good and bad data. Dismissing certain features as noise as opposed to signal is obviously necessary when, for instance, one is testing the capacity of an algorithm to determine whether a text is written by a woman or a man based on pronoun usage, or differentiating American from British fiction based on relative frequencies of the word the. These are both examples drawn from closed games in which a particular objective is in mind, but the difficulty arises when one tries to broaden these examples out to make broader arguments about literary history or theory, as Matthew Jockers does when he argues that the success of these algorithms, which are true, they happen, they're quite successful in making correct estimations, that they disprove Roland Barthes' theory of the death of the altar. And in making this point, Jockers risks overlooking the potential usefulness and indeed applicability of the death of the author to the results of his own analyses. As he himself notes, his finding demonstrates the genre, time of composition, codifies language use to such an extent that it seems to overwhelm the author's individual writing style, without considering that the whole point of the theory might be that authorial signal, broadly considered, might be inextricable from the context in which it arises. So this is one of the more peculiar features of Jockers and Moretti's approaches, which are attempting to account for structural determinations behind generic and formal change, while ignoring already existing theoretical schools where theories of generic development are understood in precisely these terms. And it's furthermore ironic, I think, that they try to improve upon overly individualistic accounts of genre by depending upon theories derived from behavioral economics, arguing genre works according to Arthur Devaney and W. David Wall's concept of the information cascade, whereby formal changes enacted by individuals assume a structural scale due to the market's capacity to respond to, amplify, and disseminate awareness of what the discerning consumer or producer should be doing. What Moretti and Jockers overlook is that commercial publishing houses shape publishing trends prior to the event of publication. The event of the consumer reading the text, which surely comes after purchase, doesn't quite make sense as a primary explanatory mechanism. And that in the period of time in which they're mostly considering the 19th and 20th centuries, government enforced laws against the publication of obscene material would have been something worth considering. Thomas Hardy complained in an 1890 article that he was often unable to write what he wanted in his novels because there was an expectation that as reading was a communal experience in middle class families, there was an assumption that what was published in a novel would be suitable for children to read. Moretti and Jockers therefore seem to naturalize capitalism's logic in assuming success to be an objective measure of worth, and Prendergast has argued against this, charging it with this and their dependence on evolutionary theory to be a eugenic history of literature which amounts to social Darwinism. I have a quote there from Joe Cleary just about citing Paul Delaney's research into Moody's Select Library and the publishing houses which acted as sort of cultural oligarchs in that period of time, exerting a significant amount of control over the sort of text that would appear in print. So just in concluding, and in emphasising the importance of context in my own quantitative analyses, I'm going to provide a very brief account of the results which have come from my own network analysis of 640 novels and short story collections divided roughly evenly between the 19th and 20th centuries. Jockers is the only other extant network analysis of literature that I'm aware of. He obviously has more computing power and he has several thousand novels, but both of us use the open source visualization software Gephi. Now, I don't know what Jockers' network analysis is doing, because he doesn't say, but my ones at least are connected based on the strength of their stylistic similarity metric, which is usually the 5,000 most frequent words an author uses and the amount of times that they do so with the relative weight or strength of a network's edge, which is the line that exists between all these nodes, signifying the strength of the association. Jockers removes his anachronistic edges, i.e. the ones that would show something like Elizabeth Bowen's The Last September exerting a significant degree of influence on Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, which would of course be impossible, with a view to determining the most influential text. The algorithm he runs on them was designed incidentally by Google's founders, and it finds that Lawrence Stern's The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, a Gentleman, was the most influential text in his corpus. And this is a pattern that I find replicated. You know, this doesn't show up as well on a big screen, I'm sorry. But the big green one in the exact centre here is Finnegan's Wake, and this one here is Herman Melville's Marty and a Voyage Hither. Now, I wouldn't draw any argument straight away about why these are the most influential or best text, but I think this is because they're the most stylistically heterogeneous. I think that the algorithm rewards that. And, sorry, you see that? On the top right-hand corner, sort of on the, what would you call that, the northeast sector, you can see that there's some pink novels moving in there. Pink in 19th century and the green is the 20th century. Well, that crossover is the late 19th century American novelist Stephen Crane being pulled into a cluster of naturalistic novels by like Frank Norris and Jack London. And increasingly in the critical discourse, this naturalism is being considered as fulfilling a proto-modernist late Victorian impulse. So this is all preliminary, of course, but just to give an indication of how these methods can and I think should work in conjunction with the historicization of text and what we're thrown back on is absolutely not a reductive or depoliticized formalism, but rather the notion of language as being low, absolutely determined by the context in which it is deployed and stratified by it. So that's about all. Thanks so much for your attention.